Next week represents the last week of the first half of the semester, and we close with Piranesi and a shift in consciousness from the individual to the collective. The collective body becomes important, and when the collective body becomes important, we have what later psychologists and psychiatrists call the collective unconscious, that is a kind of spirit that transcends the individual and also transcends the sense of the consciousness, that is the political and social and economic manifestations of collectivity. And what is introduced, and which is part of where the modern era begins, is the notion of the negative, because with the unconscious, in any kind of psychological matrix, the unconscious represents that which is repressed by consciousness often, and manifests itself in various different ways. It has in a male, it is the female energy. In the female, it's male energy. I mean, it's a dialectical yin-yang relationship. We all attempt to be conscious, but that consciousness is somehow prodded by the unconscious. And the unconscious can be seen in the yin-yang situation of as the shadow, the darkness, the negative. And so it is very difficult in the complex society that we live in today to ignore the negative, because it is that, it's also very powerful energy. If we can harness negative energy, many things that merely that exist in the social, that is political, economic realm, can be brought to bear in architecture. So what we have beginning next week is a voyage, the first voyage into the unconscious. And I think you've got to be aware, we've shown how the world has changed from the relationship of a theocentric condition where a transcendental metaphysics moved to an immanent one, the transcendental being a supreme being mediating man and nature, to an immanent metaphysics where the subject man became prominent, had a relationship to the object, to nature, and to God, that the subject became a mediator. So what we're going to see is, first of all, the beginnings of the breakdown today of the subject as centered in the church, and a movement toward, in the Counter-Reformation, the breakup of the church, and in the 18th century, we're going to see a breakup of the whole feudal system of the world into from city-states to nations and to the collective. So next week we're going to look at Piranesi's Campo Marzio, which is one of the more famous ideas of city, and you are going to look at the typological elements that make up this city, and you are going to do a critical analysis. In other words, not just what they are, a description. I mean, everybody can see circles and squares and triangles. What makes the relationship of those circles and squares and triangles critical? So I don't want a description of what is. I want you to look at what is and suggest what makes, because when you look at the Campo Marzio, you're going to obviously see it's different than any other city plan that you've ever seen. You are going to look and say, what is it about the juxtaposition of architectural elements that makes it different? So we're now moving from the individual building to a collective strategy, that is the urban strategy. And what we're going to see is, if we go back to Alberti, Alberti said that a house is a small city and a city is a large house, that there was, in Alberti's mind, an ineffable and an ineluctable relationship between the individual building and the manifestation of city, of the urbis. And what we will see is that as the world becomes more complex, the Albertian dictum, which has survived through modern architecture, as we will see, begins in the late 18th century to be questioned. And we're going to look at that kind of questioning, that no longer can the city be defined by the individual building, no longer can the individual building suggest the city. And because the city now is the locus of a very complex condition called the collective, and the collective in a political sense, and also the collective in an unconscious sense. That is, another Geist is loose in the world. In addition, we will find in the 18th century and 19th century a whole raft of new building types. And the idea of a building type becomes important. Prior to that, the church was the focus of the town, the church, then the street. And there were very few other buildings that mattered. Everything else was infill. But now we have other symbolic buildings. We have town halls. We have libraries. We have the beginning of museums. We have the beginning of publishing and printing. As an industry. We then have, because of the recognition of the negative, we have prisons, we have schools, we have factories, all of which change the idea of a city, that the symbolic buildings are no longer merely the churches, that there are a multitude of symbolic buildings. And so what we're going to see in Piranesi, as we did, for example, in Palladio, where Palladio takes the Roman bath and turns it into a church, we're going to see in Piranesi the movement from Roman forms, typical Roman organizations, into fantastic new compositions for new functions. And so Piranesi is both the beginning and the end, and also the transition to what I would call the modern period. Now, we've talked about the fact that Bramante could be seen as the first modern because he moved classical architecture to a degree zero and instituted the idea of an organism, that the city or the building as an organism. We can also look at Piranesi and begin to see another kind of organism. Not an organism of the whole, but an organism of the fragmented parts. And so we see the fragmentation beginning now in the transition from the Palladian through the Baroque. And we're going to look at three Baroque architects today, Borromini, Bernini, and Carlo Rinaldi. So we are sequencing through a series of transitions that will make you familiar with the major players in this sort of stream of history that talks about the relationship of architecture as a political, social, and cultural instrument. Okay? So, any questions about where we are? Yeah.
Are you saying that the collective unconsciousness...
not unconsciousness, the unconscious.
...arised as a concept or an actuality at that time?
No, it was a... It doesn't become conscious until psychology becomes, in the 19th century, the late 19th century, psychology becomes an operative social phenomenon, all right? It's not recognized, let's say, until a century later. What I'm suggesting is, if you look back at the artifacts, you begin to see the operation of the negative, the operation of the fragment at a scale which can only suggest that there is a collective unconscious, okay? And there's the difference between a collective unconscious and individual unconscious. Now, for example, if we were to look at Shakespeare, much of the symbolism in Shakespeare is all to do with the individual unconscious, all right? I mean, Hamlet's character, the ghosts that he sees, the things he sees are manifestations of his psychological world, right? Macbeth, Julius Caesar, I mean, on it, you know, King Lear, are all manifestations of the problematic of the individual in relationship to his social or her social situation, the forces, the unconscious forces that take over from these in these characters, which are metaphors for the individual condition. What happens is that when there becomes a social condition, that is a body politic, that idea of the unconscious is transferred into a collective condition. Into a collective unconscious. There's no question that Hitler was able to do to Germany what he did by preying on the collective unconscious of the German people. He was very clever in using political and social and historical conditions to open the Germans to the kinds of horror that was to follow. And it seemed quite natural because they were not able to realize, to control their own unconscious feelings. They became part of the collective. Kant was the first one, and the reason why it happens in Germany is Kant said that the German social condition was that the individual didn't exist, that the individual was the state. And that it was important to understand the German idea was that the individual was identified, his or her being was identified as the state. Now, as we know in this country, the Jeffersonian ideal is absolutely the opposite. We couldn't have a dictator here because 90% of the people want to do what they want to do. And they are the individual the idea of states' rights. I mean, the struggle for the organization of this country between a federal system and a states' system is very key. And so we have the Jeffersonian idea, which is so strong here and very weak, let's say, in Germany. So it begins, let's say, in the late 18th, early 19th century with the Kantian philosophy that says the individual unconscious is the state. And we see the results. So it's articulated philosophically in Kant first. It's articulated metaphorically in Shakespeare and other writers. It's in Dante, Dante's Inferno, I mean the descent into the stages of hell. In Goethe, there are any number of writers that articulate these phenomena, but they are not collected together as a psychology until the late 19th century. But architecture manifests these things. I mean, you don't have to be told, you all may never have been to an analyst to know that there are things that come up in your dreams and, you know, things that you are not in control of, right? And that cause things either good or bad to happen that come out of some or situation, right? And the whole idea of psychology is to make one aware of what those things are, both the collective phenomena that influence one, because the collective unconscious is very strong. I mean, how one dresses here. As I say, 50 years ago, everybody would have been in a coat and tie. Now, how come they're not in coat and ties today? Because there's a collective phenomenon that people, you know, want to subscribe to. My son goes to a boarding school now where he went to a school in the city last year, and he's changed enormously because he catches the collective unconscious, what he's supposed to be to fit in. And the desire to fit in is very strong. So I think that what we're going to see are these phenomenon now displayed in architecture and in city.
So is it not just an unconscious expression of the commonality of human experience, but it has a kind of metaphysical component to it as well?
I'm not getting what.
I mean,
for example, it doesn't matter whether Piranesi was conscious that he was expressing a collective unconscious. We're looking at the conditions of. We're not analyzing the psychological nature of the individuals, you know, their clients, etc., why they did certain things. So let's not pursue that line of questioning. I don't care whether it is or it isn't, because we're learning what the compositional effects of these things are, not why there were these compositional effects, but in fact what they are and how they manifested themselves in building and in cities. So what the metaphysical component of the terror of 1789 I don't care. I want to know what the architectural consequences were. You don't need to analyze the social situation today to do architecture. You need to know how to do architecture first, right? And that's what we're trying to do here, is to learn what architecture is, how it operates, not the analysis of architecture and the civic condition. But of course, we could stop the course and start with the sack of Rome and the Reformation and start looking at those things in the zeitgeist, in the spirit of the age, which caused architecture to change. But how those are picked up by individuals, etc., would be truly a psychological and perhaps metaphysical or transcendental study, which I can't do. I'm not equipped to do. And you shouldn't ask me. I'm only teaching you not why, but what. And we're looking at what's, right? And you can then make up a story about the why as good as anybody if you want. But I'm concerned that you know what these things are, and the whole, let's say, canon of objects that take the history from a theocentric to an anthropocentric to a technocentric to an ecocentric to whatever, psychocentric condition. Okay? To non-centric, you know, the fragmentation of the center. And as Foucault said, that once there is sociology and psychology, that is where man looks at man, okay? That is through the social sciences. Once they become instantiated in the 19th century, then anthropocentrism can't exist because man can't be at the center and at the periphery looking at himself at the same time. So there's a radical change in the cosmology with the idea of social sciences. Now, I'm not going to try and make a link between that radical change in the cosmology when social sciences came to be and what the architecture looked like. What I'm interested in is that you know how the architecture changed, not why it changed. Okay? Because that's another subject. And I've got to focus you all into the architectural changes and being able to articulate those. So, I mean, the same thing with music. If we were studying musical composition, I need you to understand the difference between Renaissance music and Baroque music, how it's orchestrated, how it's played, how it's harmonies and disharmonies, how it's organized, not why there was a change, right? Because you have to know how it is, not why it is, in this class. Supposedly, you know the social history, or more or less, if you've had any social sciences, which some of you had to have in university. So. Any other questions? Because to do what you're asking me would, you know, we'd be here all day, all night, and we wouldn't do anything else. I mean, you could argue, why do I need to draw anything, right? Why don't I just need to understand? You know, and I'm not convinced that's not so. My roommate in New York in 1957 had gone to Yale and studied economics, and he went to work for Morgan Bank. And Morgan Bank said, we don't want our people to have gone to the business school at Harvard because they teach them things that have nothing to do with what this bank is interested in. We're interested in people that know economics, know what the discipline of economics is. We'll teach them banking. We'll teach them business. I could argue that the School of Architecture at Yale shouldn't teach design, but should teach you architecture. When you come to my office, I'll teach you design. And of course, Yale Law School is very much that way. Yale Law School doesn't train people to be active lawyers. They teach them the discipline of the law, the philosophy of the law, etc. Whereas Harvard Law School teaches a case study method, and you learn how to practice law. Okay. If anything, I would make an enormous distinction between Yale and Harvard as schools of architecture, where Harvard for certain teach people how to practice architecture. Yale is somewhere sort of fuzzy in the middle. Princeton is all the way to the right, where there's very little teaching people how to practice architecture. I think it's an enormous mistake for schools of architecture to teach people practice, because you never get these other opportunities. And if you just know how to practice, then you don't know, in a sense, why. And I think what we're talking about here is the why of the discipline, not the why of the social conditions that cause the discipline to be what it is. Any other questions? Yes.
Is there a difference between humanism in Renaissance, between humanism and modernism?
Well, what I tried to suggest was that there are two things between humanism and modernism. One is the relationship of the subject to the subject, man, woman, to God and nature. In other words, humanism is an anthropocentric phenomenon. That is, all things are mediated through man. Okay? In modernism, man is no longer the mediator. Man is the observer, let's say, of phenomenon that change. And some of those phenomenon have to do with, first of all, the social sciences. That is, politics, economics, which don't exist before a collective world. Psychology and sociology are the four basic social sciences. And the social sciences are what instantiate modernism, number one, and they also instantiate the idea of the negative. That is, the removal of the subject from the center and the removal from the consciousness of the subject as the dominating discourse to a condition of the unconscious. That those are the two things that I would cite are the important differences between humanism and modernism. Any other general question? Okay. So let's begin. Let's see, where are we going to begin with Borromini and let's go. Okay. Where is my pointer? So, we're going to start with San Ivo alla Sapienza in Rome. It's done 10 years after San Carlino, and it is La Sapienza is the first university of Rome. That is, the Sapienza being the knowing. And here is the church. And what we get now is an attempt, if in fact Alberti was interested in breaking down the component parts of a facade into the post and beam, that is, the trabeated system, and the wall system, that is, the bearing wall system. Borromini was interested in bringing the two together, that is, bringing the wall and the trabeation as a continuous surface, number one. Okay, so while there are articulations, there is the sense that the thematic is the attempt to destroy the difference, that is the articulation of the difference, and to consume both into surface. So what you get is a facade condition or a vertical surface condition that begins to be figural. That is, it is articulated and is no longer rectilinear, but is articulated as a surface continuity. The second thing that happens, not only is the idea of surface as a continual plane important in, as it were, the x-axis, but the y-axis, that is the section and the surface as it moves from the ground to the top, also changes. It modulates. And so what we begin to see here is a surface that continues here through these two stories, a kind of gasket space here, and then a different kind of, I mean, it, if this is inverted, this is extroverted. And so there is no continuity where there begins to be a fragmentation in the vertical section. There is no continuity. And this is the first time that this kind of thing, I mean, this is after San Carlino, but it's important to see these things done by Borromini. Now, what we're talking about is bringing a new dynamism into the church form. That is, to bring, as it were, as part of the Counter-Reformation, to make the church seem more active, more dynamic, etc. Can I get the next two, please? Here is the plan of San Ivo, and of course, what we're looking at is a series of two triangles overlaid. This seems fuzzy.
It is a little fuzzy.
I mean, can we fix it?
We were working on it this morning.
It doesn't. You sure you can't? Because these slides are really crisp. Why don't you take a look? But you can read a triangular condition here and here, two triangles overlaid, but the idea is to blur the boundary so that the geometry is not clear but becomes more dynamic. And you can see it in the way the poche is modeled. Keep going. Keep going. See if it. Wait, there you go. Better. It's not really, but leave it.
Good?
Yeah, well, it's good enough. We're talking about blurred boundaries anyway, so. Now, you can see the concavity here in this exedral end. You can see Serlian, I mean, if we remember Serlio from last week and the way the pieces at the corners were played in the poche, we see how these things are not all the same. These hexagons have a varied nature, and the pieces that attach to them, I mean, look at these little elements that come into them. And so you could argue that by looking at Serlio, we can see Bramante, and the difference between Serlio and Bramante, Serlio is still, even though the forms are figural, that is cut out of their a subtractive architecture. Here in Borromini, the attempt to blur the difference between a subtractive and an additive architecture, that is, to blur the geometry so that it's very difficult to know what is the organizing principle that articulates this geometry. The second thing we notice is we're no longer in cruciform churches, that is, transept, nave, apse churches. There are now churches where a greater mass of people can gather around the celebrant in an organization that allows one to feel part of a group rather than to separate the celebrant, the choir, and the mass from one another. They all become part of a more centralized space. Next, please. And here you get an analysis which shows you the two triangles of San Ivo, and how then this we have this concave and convex forms which produce this rather strange trefoil figure, which has the remnants of the triangles overlaid, but produces another figure. And of course, this is important in understanding the organization of the space of Borromini. So there is instead of the harsh lines of the triangle, if you notice, here is the only remnant of the triangle, and these remnants then become part of a continuously articulated surface that's both convex and concave. Can we have the next, please? And what happens is, as we go up through the dome also takes on different characteristics at each level. There's this six-part articulation where all six parts are the same. And then we go practically to a circular condition here, a circular drum, where there's yet another kind of articulation and another kind of poche. So that the section is not only continuous in the surface, let's say in the ground level, but as it goes up, it continues to modify its geometry. So the geometry produces a very different kind of sectional organization than we had in either, which is a simple arch situation in both of the Palladian churches, or in the Duomo of Florence, or in any of the Gothic cathedrals. Here the dome talks about a kind of fragmentation and articulation as it moves from the ground up. Next, please. And you begin to see how this surface is a continuous surface from concavity to convexity to concavity as it goes around. And then what is convex here becomes concave here, and it's like a folded surface. It's like a condition of origami, and these segmented pieces have a kind of continuous fluctuation and articulation as the dome goes up. And then you have the cupola, which again becomes part of another articulation, as you can see from this cutaway drawing. Next, please. And what you get then is the sectional modulation. And of course, one has to notice, by the way, which is important to notice, what seems to be from a section facing, let's say, the altar and the facade, a symmetrical condition. What seems to be in the round, you have to notice the sectional deviation that occurs. Look at this opening here, this opening here, this, which is the apse end, let's say, very similar to Bramante's church in Milano, the entry portico here, the differences in the poche over here in this section and over here in what appears to be a symmetrical organization, in fact, is something other. And then you have to notice the columnar rhythms. They seem to fold into one another. The overlap at this sort of intersection here between two columns or even three columns, a column here and then another double column over here. So there is this weird articulation of the columnar structure as it becomes part of the wall. It doesn't disappear, but it becomes part of the surface. It's not articulated as, let's say, in the arcade of Santa Maria della Pace or Urbino, but becomes a kind of sliding reference to structure as it becomes part of the surface. Next, please. These are the long section of San Ivo. Jeez, these are really out of focus. Yeah. I don't know what's happening. Is it? It's not my.
I mean, yesterday during our theory class, they were playing around with stuff, and they changed the resolution and everything. And the DM office doesn't know. No one's up there yet. Well, they are coming now, so they can change the resolution back.
Well, what we'll do is at the break,
yeah, I'll come
go over and you know, because these things,
yeah,
they're really hard to look at. Next, please. That slide is very different. What? I don't have that. Next. Oh, Christ. Well, that's the Palazzo done by Borromini. I don't know why those are in there. Next. Okay. Now we get to San Carlo. This is the famous Alle Quattro Fontane. It's an intersection in Rome. Here is one of the fountains. On each of the four corners, there is a diagonal with a fountain in it. And this church is set into the corner. Now, you have to notice, we have this diagonal over here. We have the facade over here and a facade over here. And the sort of how this is set in is quite important. This is a really important facade because it has both a concavity and a convexity in its surface. And it also has a series of niches. Let's say here's the portico here. A niche here, a little object here with an opening, and then a rondel which is set into the pediment here. No longer is the pediment the Greek style, but it's without any diagonal. And instead there's this fractured corner pediment here, which we will then again see as we go into Carlo Rinaldi and the idea of the idicular structure. which we will see very clearly articulated in the Carlo Rinaldi Church. So even though this is before San Ivo, it has some of the things that will go forward into later Baroque manifestations. Next, please. And there is an etching from the time, and you can see one of the fountains over here, another one over here, one over here at these corners. Next. And I think it's important to see that the facade, first of all, is now a dynamic facade. It's not a plane, but it's a series of volumes that are it's undulating. The cornice line and the pediment, this cornice line undulates through, and this one is broken by this large rondel. It has a new idea of what the facade of the church wants to be. And there's no question, let's say, that if we jump from Alberti San Andrea to the facade work of Bramante, to the facade work of Palladio, to the facade work of Borromini, and then to Rinaldi, we are getting to the final, as it were, dissolution of the notion of a rigid vertical, horizontal, X, Y, Z coordinate architecture. And of course, what then happens, the final dissolution is with Piranesi, breaks everything apart, and then with the French Revolution, the idea of the state emerging, we get a very rigorous, rigid, neoclassical architecture which restores Platonic geometry, does away with figuration, does away with, as it were, any of the references to the church, and the church now becomes back to a kind of neo-Grec, very spare condition. That is, we lose all of this buildup of the dynamic. And of course, the dynamic had to do with the possibility of the church in the Counter-Reformation. Next. And Baroque Rome is full of things like this, and one can look very carefully at the giant orders, the scaled pieces, the way things break out of their niches. I mean, look at these figures here that are, things are no longer in their place necessarily, but are part of the flow of figuration across the facade. Next, please. Now, again, if we look at the plan of San Carlo, again, I want to, the reason why I showed you Serlio last week is this is pure Serliana. If we look at the shapes of these pieces in the corners, this is the influence of Serlio, at least in the plan of Borromini, is quite staggering. And of course, again, we now have, instead of San Ivo, which is this overlay of two triangles, we now have this compressed oval form where there is a strong linear axis from the front, and you get the sense of a kind of compression of what will be later San Ivo, a compression that's caused by the property line over here, which doesn't allow for an expansion, and this rectilinear room over here. Now, this is really important that this room over on the side echoes in its regularity the regularity of the property line over here, so that you have, as it were, a vice-like structure, a rectilinear object pressing against a rectilinear plane, which causes a compression in the space. And that compression then spirals up also in the third dimension. So when we look at this, we always must relate any artifact to some pure artifactual condition, either an ideal centralized plan, as in Palladio's variations, or in an idealized geometry from which you can argue this takes its energy. So here we have in these two churches the collapse of the ideality or the ground zero condition of Bramante, and we have the collapse of the mannerist, that is the play on ideality. There's nothing ideal about this organization. We can no longer read the traditional ABCBA that still remains in a distorted state in both Serlio and Palladio. Here, there's another series of rhythms which take over, which do not allow for this typological construction that you could read in Serlio. But you still get the Serlian discourse as it appears in these side chapels. Next, please. And then you get a series of transitional readings of these different plans, a series of different plan analysis from, for example, San Ivo to San Carlo next, and various ways of looking at the organization of the geometry. Next. And then you look at, again, the way the section goes up through the dome, and you get this layers of different geometries, a geometry down here, a different geometry here, a different one here, and one here as it goes up through. So there's this sort of layering of different geometries, none relating to one another, and this is the longitudinal section, this is the transverse section, which is again symmetrical, and this is again an asymmetrical section, as you can read here to here, here and here, as it progresses up through the building. Next, please. And again, models which are very useful to understand the organization of San Carlino. Next, please. And the cupola. Next. Next. Okay. So we now are at 20 to 11. Let's take a 10-minute break. We'll come back and look at Carlo Rinaldi, and you'll take go and see if you can get that fixed. How the drawings look this week?
Good.
Yeah? Good? Okay. So here we go. I don't think we got it.
No. These two were already out of focus. The rest of the slides are in focus.
Oh, they are. Why are those two out of focus?
I don't know. They are in the PowerPoint.
They are?
Yeah.
But did they change the thing up
yeah.
there?
Yeah.
Oh, Jesus. They can't be in the PowerPoint.
No, I swear. You can get them here in the PowerPoint out of focus.
Really?
Yeah. They were on my computer as well upstairs.
Okay. Now, we're going to look at two churches that you all have looked at. The church on the left is the Church of Monte Santo, and the church on the right is Santa Maria dei Miracoli, and the church on the left is by Bernini, or the alterations of it. The first plan was, and the one on the right is by Carlo Rinaldi. Now this is the Piazza del Popolo, and why don't we go to the next slide. And there is an early drawing of the Piazza del Popolo, and you can see this is Santa de Monte Santo and de Miracoli there. And what happens is two different ideas of being. Okay, one is the fact that there is an axis with an obelisk, and this is the Trident, this is the Corso, the main street of Rome, and this was one of the two streets that formed this Trident, and the two churches are situated in such a way to appear to be symmetric. Now the two sites are asymmetric. Now what Rinaldi was interested in doing is in the objective condition of the object, okay? And this is important. What Bernini was interested in was the scenographic relationship of the object to the whole, so that it looked like there was asymmetry. So the difference between Rinaldi, who's interested in the object, and Bernini, who's interested in the subjective view of the object, is very important. And one is trying to organize the relationship of the exterior to the interior, Rinaldi, and Bernini is trying to organize the relationship of this particular church to this church. Even though the site is different, he's trying to make it look perspectivally like the same condition. And so what you get is this different view of the world. One, the objective view of the world, and the other, the subjective view of the world. In other words, this is Tate, what we were just talking about before. What is the actual object, its criticality, versus how do people perceive the object, and how does the object cause people to perceive it, either symmetrically, as a pair, as part of the fabric, as distended from the fabric, etc. Bernini was interested in the subjective view of the world, and Rinaldi was interested in the objective view of the world. And on the exam, that's basically all one has to know. Okay, the next, please. You have to notice that although the integers are basically the same, a pediment, four columns, side aisles, and a dome with a cupola and a bell tower on either side, you have to notice there's a difference in the organization of these columns. There's more of a compression and vertical elongation of these columns as opposed to this cupola and condition here, because this is a wider site and this is a narrower site. So it's important to see this is compressed, and the whole idea is that in this extension, it would seem to be the same as this, is that Bernini wanted this to look like this rather than to be like it. Next, please. And you can see the site, the different angles of the site as they were actually there. And this is an early plan of the church by Rinaldi, which has, and we're going to see it repeated in the church of Santa Maria in Campitelli, that is the play now, and we have to see Rinaldi as an overlay of Palladio on top of Borromini. That is a striation which interrupts the continuity of the surface. So if we were to say Borromini has something like this, a centralized Latin cross, we then have these two lateral chapels which become, as it were, like secondary transepts which striate the whole structure. So we have a striation where the front facade, which is both concave and convex, is separated from the main body. So we have this kind of transition. We have this condition here, a transition, poche, transition, poche, large center, poche, transition, poche, and then apse. This is what makes Rinaldi very interesting, is the superposition of two different ideas, a as it were, striated or layered idea as opposed to a centralized figural idea that's in Borromini. So what Rinaldi, who comes after Borromini, is attempting to do is to create a superposition of the object where there is no single ground, but you have a fluctuating ground for architecture. So we have now in Rinaldi the first time the duality. In other words, two, as it were, genres or two compositional modes overlaid on one another where one is not more important than the other. And I think that's, to me, one of the interesting conditions where Rinaldi becomes a very important architect in this sequence. This is the first time we have not just a single thematic, but a double thematic. That is a play between two. Next, please. And we have on the this is De Miracoli here on the right and Monte Santo on the left, what you begin to see is how Bernini changed the structure from a cruciform here, and this is the second plan for Rinaldi's De Miracoli, and we see vestiges of the early plan, but it's not, it's still, the cruciform is still there, overlaid on top of a secondary structure. Whereas what Bernini does is make something a single organism, that is the, and there, when you go into these churches, they look similar from the outside. There is this scenographic intention on Bernini, but in order to produce that scenography, he's got to alter the plan to make it a single unity because of the nature of the site. And what happens is, when you see the interiors, even though the exteriors have a similitude, the organization of this space is so different than this space, and it's the difference between a unity of composition, that is, so that the subject understands the whole and the relationship of the part to the whole, thus the building to the city. That is, the Albertian idea of the city is a large house and the object is a small city. This is Alberti, and this is the breakdown of that Albertian idea in Santa Maria dei Miracoli. That is, Rinaldi, and then followed on by Piranesi, is the breakdown of this relationship between the part to the whole. And of course, the part to the whole relationship was the whole idea of the anthropocentrism of humanism. That is, the part, the individual, related to the cosmos, as in many of the figures inscribed in traditional geometries. Whereas Rinaldi, where, let's say, Borromini is the integration of the elements into a whole, Rinaldi now is using those elements to disintegrate the parts. And so no longer does this interior relate to its exterior as this interior relates to its exterior. And so Rinaldi begins to be the dissolution of the relationship of the part to the whole. Next, please. Here we have, for me, one of the really interesting and important church in the Roman wall church condition, and that is Santa Maria in Campatelli. And what is interesting about Santa Maria in Campatelli are there are two different rhythms that are working. There is a rhythm across the facade and a rhythm that is pushing up through the facade. So there's a cross rhythm and a pushing rhythm, but the cross rhythm is not the same as the Borromini cross rhythm, but has something to do with something known as the idicular or idicule. And the idicule is where there are a condition of columns which relate the bay so that you have a column here and a column here. This column is square, this column is round. These two columns define that space. But because this column is round, it joins to this column here, and in other words, jumps across to define a space here. And the idicule is where the columnar structures overlap in such a way as to provide both a disassociation and a doubling, so that you read this column in relation to this column, but this column doubles. It relates to this and also relates to this. And then you have a second condition of this column here, which both relates to this and to this one. And so we get a situation where, if you look, you have this column relating to this column relating to this one, but this column also relating to this column. And it's this doubling, this superposition of columnar relationships proposed by this additional column here, which causes this facade to be what is called idicular. That's one part of the idicular idea. And the second is the
playing of the thrusting of this pediment through this cornice line here. There's a cornice line that continues at the lower cornice line here, where the columns come. And then there is a second cornice line here, where this pediment, which is also segmented and broken here, thrusts here. There is a small pediment here, so there is a second, as it were, idicular structure with a broken pediment here. Then we have a minor pedimented structure and an arced pediment which breaks into and thrusts up into the final pediment. So whereas Palladio's pediments come down sequentially one on another, Rinaldi's pediments thrust up through the vertical condition of the facade. It is this irresolution between the pairing of the columns and the thrusting up through that causes this project to be, say, critical of the facades at Piazza del Popolo, or the facades of Borromini, which were critical of the facades of Palladio, which were critical of the facades of Bramante. So, again, using architectural elements to produce different thrusts and dynamic conditions of reading where there is no stable or static reading, but two readings are always overlapping one another to create this instability. So you see the instability in the plan and you see it in the facade. And it's this instability that characterizes, in a sense, it is not a mannerism from stable. In other words, in mannerism, let's say in Palladio or Giulio Romano or Serlio, there is a stable condition where there's a deviation. What that would be a one condition over another where there's still a base. That would be superimposition. So there's a difference between superimposition where there's a base and a distortion from the base, and superposition where there are two conditions which either could be base or the distortion. There is no ground given. And so the difference in Rinaldi to Palladio is that Palladio is a superimposition of a distortion on a normal base, whereas in Rinaldi the normal base is gone and you have two conditions that have equal weight. Can I get the next, please? And of course, here to me is one of the great plans. You can see echoes of Redentore, you can see echoes of San Giorgio, but the slicing and dicing of this thing is that you can't read a stable figure, because now, if you notice, and first of all, look at how the poche becomes all, is no longer figural in the curved sense of the word, even though, and look at the way the poche works on the facade, but look at, they're now much more rectilinear, hard edge, and you get the poche of the facade, which is already indented, but it's not concave or convex. You get this gasket space through here, and a second gasket here, so that there is no wall. The wall is sliced and diced, so they're just a constant series of cuts through it, small compressed cuts like this, and the figures become unstable, because here you read fragments of an octagon, it's almost figural, and then it's cut again between this octagon and this half round. So you have that slice, this this, and this. And to me, it's one of the great plans because it's the first time we have no stability. In other words, the thing is either a series of planes, layers of planes, or a series of figures which are cut, but neither one of them is dominant. And when you go into Santa Maria in Campitelli, you feel that layering. You feel the the sort of like an accordion plan. You can feel that in the play, the space itself. And if you go into Redentore and Santa Maria Maggiore in Venice, and you realize its difference from Roman wall churches or the churches, the idea of the Gothic church, and then you read Borromini's churches. And so here we have, as it were, for me, Borromini and Palladio superposed on one another to produce another organism. Not the organism of Bramante, but an organism which has no stable base. And of course, this instability leads us then to Piranesi next week and to the modern condition where there is no, the center no longer exists as a whole condition. It is fragmented. We have in the center the reverse, the negative condition, and we have a series of figures in Piranesi which don't hold together there, and we'll see when we look at the Piranesi drawings next week. Next, please. There is the actual idicular structure, and I think that the same kind of, I mean, if we were to say, where is the surface of the facade? It is so layered, I mean, by this surface here, which is dominant at this point. Then the clustering of columns here, both square and half round, and then another columnar structure here, and a niche here, a niche up here. And we see the same kind of cutting of the, in other words, these layers, which are in the horizontal plane in plan, are cut through the cornice line here, cut into the pediment here, cut through the cornice here, a secondary thrusting here, so that if we were to take and lay this down flat, we'd have the same kind of layered and sliced articulation that we have in the plan. This is, when you go and see this, it's quite an extraordinary piece when you compare it to, say, the Gesù by Vignola, the Borromini pieces, even Piranesi's own church. It has, you can understand how the facade has moved from Borromini through Bernini to Rinaldi. Next. And the modeling, when you go, for example, to see a Borromini, where the edges of the modeling of the columns and the capitals and the bases are softer in an attempt to provide a continuity between the wall surface. Here, if you notice, the cornices here are cut very sharply, and there's a sharp everywhere. There's the cut, and the cut into the cornice line here is an articulation. The cut into this arch structure here, the cutting of the plaster work is amazingly crisp, cool, and you see a very different kind of articulation of the relationship of column to wall surface that will lead eventually to the disengagement from This is what you would call late Baroque, and we could take the Baroque through Borromini to Guarini to Rinaldi, and then bingo, we have Piranesi, and then neoclassicism. And it's important to see how the fragmentation that is in Rinaldi doesn't suit the new attempt to bring the body politic together in the French Revolution, and we need, and they need an entirely different kind of architecture. And so you go from the dissolution, which is the modern and which reappears after the 19th century, neoclassicism, again in the fragmentation that becomes the complexity of the world today. So we see Rinaldi again is this transitional figure between both Bernini, Borromini, and Piranesi, but also the superposition of Palladio onto somebody like Borromini. Next. Okay. Let's see. Okay, we're... any questions about where we are before we go look at the drawing? Yeah. Santa Maria in Campitelli.